issues. So we're calling Anthony right about now, and he should be with us momentarily. Anthony publishes zines, which he sends to prisoners, and he gets writings from prisoners and publishes them as well. Very active guy.
I'm sorry, but the person you called has a voicemail box that has not been set up yet.
We're going to have to try that again because that didn't work. I spoke to him just a minute ago, so he should be waiting for us. We'll try again. Hopefully we can get hold of Anthony this time. Something strange going on. Let's try one more time.
Hello.
Well, hello, Anthony.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi.
We had some glitches getting to you, but I'm glad that we finally got to you. I've already told the audience who you are, so please go right ahead. Say what you have to say tonight.
Very good. Well, thank you. Tonight I want to focus on a special lady named Nancy Kirshon, who was one of the co-founders of the Youth International Party in the late 60s. I was lucky enough to meet with her about 10 years ago at an event called the College of Complexes, which is a unique kind of weekly event on the north side of Chicago, where someone does a presentation and everyone gets up to argue and talk about everything. It's a lot of fun, actually, and I've done about maybe four or five of them myself the last couple decades. Anyway, Nancy, aside from being one of the co-founders of the Yippies, does a lot of serious prison support and writing. I carry a couple of her zines. One of them is called Women in Imprisonment in the United States, History and Current Reality. There's two different versions, kind of a long and sharp version. And she wrote a fantastic book called Out of Control about the pandemic control unit in the United States. What I want to read from her tonight is from a piece written by her called From Tiger Cages to Control Units. Sort of ties together the Vietnam with the horrific mass incarceration in the United States. So it starts out the 1970 trip to Vietnam. As a 26-year-old co-founder of the Yippies, the Youth International Party, I traveled to North Vietnam in 1970 as part of the all-women's peace delegation. I believe that the Vietnamese people should have been able to determine their own destiny, and that the U.S. had no business over there. Ho Chi Minh said nothing is more precious than independence and freedom. I understood what he meant. Despite a ban by the U.S. government on travel to North Vietnam, I took the risk of an illegal trip to see for myself what was happening there so that I could report what I saw with my own eyes and be a more effective anti-war organizer back home. I also went to express solidarity with the Vietnamese resistance and to acknowledge our common humanity. I had no idea in advance that I would also have an opportunity to address the American PIs in between rock songs on Vietnamese radio and encourage them to lay down their arms. Before the trip, I already fondly appreciated being in the media. Like many others, I saw them through the lens of the David and Goliath story. Most Vietnamese are a little smaller in stature, and there were iconic photos in the media of a small Vietnamese woman juxtaposed with a huge, burly American GI who she was guarding as a prisoner. But more importantly, the U.S. military was the most powerful in the world with massive weaponry and unlimited resources. On the other hand, the Vietnamese had the collective strength of their people and the love of people throughout the world. I was a socialist, and I saw the Vietnamese struggle in an attempt to wrest control of their country's destiny. To build a society where people cared more about each other than about amassing personal wealth. Much of the population was grateful for these goals. They were led by people like Ho Chi Minh, General Nguyen Xuân Phúc, and Madam Nguyễn Thị Binh. I saw those individuals who were intelligent and caring, whose love for the people was their primary motivation. I was struck by the fact that Ho Chi Minh was a poet, General Gap was a school teacher, prior to leading the military effort, as was Madam Binh. Before her role in the Provisional Revolutionary Government and later as a negotiator of peace accords, which incidentally my father participated in. In 1970, however, it was not the leaders of the struggle who we encountered in Vietnam. Rather, we met with the ordinary people of Vietnam who were carrying out extraordinary tasks. Some of them part of the long-haired army, the civilian movement composed largely of women. Who engaged in much of the legal work in the movement for national liberation. As a woman, I was also impressed that the leaders of the struggle thought that women actually mattered. Does that ring a bell? Ho said women make up half of society. If women are not liberated, then society is not free. My visit confirmed what I had heard, that women involved in every level of the struggle. Some say my view of the Vietnamese struggle was a romantic one. I continue to believe it was basically accurate that the generation of Vietnamese inspired people in movements for liberation. They asserted there was a commonality among the human family and fostered a worldwide camaraderie among those who struggled. It proved that victory was possible over the world's most powerful military machine ever assembled. It was a mythic battle, and one that continues to reverberate today. I left Vietnam in 1970 armed spiritually and informationally to fight harder to end the war. But I also left lessons that would energize my political activity for the next 43 years. I left believing that ordinary people could overcome extraordinary challenges, particularly if they work together. I left believing that people united could change real for the better. I left believing that the pursuit of justice was a worthy life activity. Back in the U.S., I continued to participate in the movement to end war and later joined other social justice activities, opposing racism at home and U.S. wars in Central America. Beginning in 1985, I fought 15 years to end long-term solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. Well, not the long-term solitary confinement, of course, but the will to struggle for 15 years against torture that existed in U.S. prisons. When we began that work in 1985, people thought I was crazy if I mentioned torture. It was a difficult uphill battle. And sometimes we kept on battling all those 15 years as we watched state after state build control unit forces out of solitary confinement prisons. What inspired us to keep going with such an uphill battle? One part of the answer is the people of Vietnam during the 60s and 70s. And in 2014, we returned to Vietnam. I'd always wanted to revisit Vietnam, but felt that returning as a tourist would be uncomfortable. When the Vietnamese invited American anti-war activists to return for the celebration of the 40th anniversary of the first peace accords, I jumped at the opportunity. It turned out to be an extraordinary two weeks. Very briefly, I found the land to be exquisitely beautiful, the people vibrant and welcoming. visiting schools, attending children who are victims of agent orange was a heart-wrenching, indelible experience. Crossing over the demilitarized zone, DMZ, into a united Vietnam was a dream come true. Climbing down into the Cochise tunnels, fitting the history of the guerrilla insurgency was amazing. The most striking moment, however, was having the opportunity to exchange a few words and be embraced by Madam Din. The experience that led me to think about my own work was the economy of these women and men who had been imprisoned and tortured in the Tiger cages. The Tiger cases in Vietnam. A prison such as the one in Tan Son Island, 200 miles off the south coast of Vietnam, there were the tiger cages, 5 feet by 9 feet, so named because of their similarity to those that house such animals. It was the same size, and one could not even stand up in them. Many Vietnamese were tortured directly by Americans before being turned over to the Saigon authorities. The torture at the Tiger Cages was carried out by Saigon police and military with the U.S. complicity. The U.S. government paid their salaries, instructed them, delivered people to them, and was completely knowledgeable about torture. All this was kept secret from the American people, however, until then U.S. President Richard Nixon sent a congressional delegation to Vietnam in 1970. In order to visit the prison in Vietnam, the U.S. POWs, the delegation was required by the North Vietnamese government to also visit the Tiger Cages of Vietnam. Thanks to people like Don Luce, who would today be considered a whistleblower, the American public became informed about these cages. I'm drawn up by a former prisoner. Part of the delegation bravely took it upon themselves to deviate from the official tour in order to see what was really going on. Don Luce just cracked three fingers cut off. Another whose skull was split open. And many with open sores or ankles as a result of shackling. Much of this was justified by the U.S.-backed South Vietnamese government, which claimed prisoners and criminals, prisoners of war, and therefore they were not protected by the Geneva Convention in 1949-50. When we returned in 2013 to Vietnam for the celebration of the 40th anniversary of defending the first Peace Accords, we spent much of the day with Vietnamese survivors of the Tiger Cages. They told us that at the time of the Accords, there was about 6,000 political prisoners, all of whom were opposed to the Saigon regime. The torture employed by the U.S. Saigon regime With the full support of the U.S. government and military was extreme. Bamboo splinters were shoved under prisoners' fingernails. Soapy water was poured in their ears and their ears pounded. Many of the women were raped as well as tortured. Many prisoners were blinded in the course of the torture. The people we met who had been in prison for 13 years, 10 years, 7 years. Explained that the cages were down below ground level. And the guards would walk overhead of the roof of the cage, which was made up of iron bars. Sometimes prisoners would be thrown in there for no reason for days at a time. The prisoners would eat, sleep, and defecate there. At times, the guards would just leave the excrement in the cell. Other times, they would throw a line down in the cell in order to blind the prisoners. One night, 1961, 17 people were tortured, five of them died and were thrown in a mass grave. Understandably, they were more excited to explain how they kept their spirits high and worked together to outsmart their torturers. Madam Wang informed us that the more heavy the anti-war movement, the better their life was in prison. What wonderful news that was to hear. Not one night our delegation was dry as Madam Han sang us one of the songs. To maintain the sanity of the U.S. on torture. The Tiger Cage in the U.S. 1963, the United States shut down the Nichols prison located on an island in San Francisco Bay. It had become too expensive to run infamous for its brutality, and its place, Marion Penitentiary in downstate Illinois, was open. Marion became the prison of the U.S. and the prisoners most hated. Among these would be well-known political prisoners and organizers who would cause U.S. trouble in other prisons. 1983, prisoners let a peaceful work staff and guards brutally beat a Mexican prisoner. Among those leaders, the strike of Rafael Campos in Miranda, a sort of North Nelson Mandela of Puerto Rico, which the U.S. held as a colony and still does. In response, for the first time ever, the U.S. locked down the entire prison, Marine lockdown, in retribution for the strike. This came to be called the control unit. Its purpose was to totally control prisoners 24/7. Greek one will never even allow them out of their cell. 2 years later, some of us living in Chicago came to believe that if there was no opposition to this horror, then the lockdown would never be ended. Thus was born the Committee to End the Marine Lockdown, CEML. I was one of the founding members of CEML. It was my life partner, Steve Whitman, and then attorney Jan Sussler. We stated from the beginning that such a brutal institution could not exist in a genuine democracy. The U.S. said that their intention was to put all of the bad apples there and must be able to free up the rest of the prison system. We said that it was just the opposite. If society gave them Marion, they would build more and more Marion, more and more control unit prison. Sadly, we were correct. Over the next 10 years, control unit prisons were built in virtually every state. Each one more brutal than the next. Each one condemned by human rights activists as inhumane and essentially torture chambers. Many people joined CML over the 10 years of existence. We varied in many ways, but had our core beliefs. A, that U.S. prisons were mechanisms of control to stop insurgency efforts, particularly by black people. And that prisons had very little to do with crime, despite the claims of the ruling elite. See, it's just prisons were instruments of control for U.S. society. Control units were instruments of control of the prison system. See that the fact that black people were eight times more likely to be sent to prison than white people indicated the true insurgents A and B above made it imperative to combat this system. There must be something about this injustice. This monstrous process would continue unimpeded. Consistent with all of this, Steve, a statistician analyzed criminal justice data and wrote a series of articles called The Crime of Black Imprisonment and The Continuing Crime of Black Imprisonment. It became widely rampant throughout the movement in the United States and beyond. I've been through the history of CML out of control, a 15-year battle against control unit prisons. It's available in form online at freedomarchives.org. African-American scholar Michelle Alexander produced a wonderful book called The New Jim Crow that addresses mass incarceration. I hope you will be able to read these sources. Control unit prisons, frequently referred to as isolation prisons, spread everywhere, most notoriously in California, which holds more prisoners than any other state. As the brutality has continued and even intensified, prisoners have said that they can no longer stand it and would rather die than live in such conditions. In July 2013, 30,000 prisoners in California's penitentiary began a hunger strike. The abolition of long-term solitary confinement is the center of their demand. As I write now, it's day 45. Reading the reports of their extreme sacrifice, I remind myself how important it was that we tried for years to shut down the first such control unit prison in downstate Illinois. Yes, for 15 years. Citizens in Illinois tried to shut down Marion Federal Penitentiary to prevent the proliferation of these institutions. And more relevantly, how important that fight remains today. We can view political social reality as a matrix of dots. It's problems unconnected to one another. But doing so will leave us with a superficial understanding of reality. Or we can try to connect the dots, try to understand what patterns emerge. And when we connect the dots, We can see that there's an intimate connection between the Tiger Cage of Vietnam, the U.S. penitentiary at Marion, California's Pelican Bay prison, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, and all the rest.
The torture employed by the U.S. Pakistan regime
with the full support of the U.S. government and military was extreme. Although there are definite instances of physical torture in U.S. prisons,
more characteristically, torture is of a psychological nature.
California, 500 prisoners have been in solitary for over 10 years, 204 for 15 years, and 78 for over 20 years. The New York Times editorial on 2/8/2011 entitled Cruel Isolation lamented that for many decades the civilized world has recognized prolonged isolation of prisoners, cruel conditions to be inhumane, even torture. The Geneva Convention forbids it.
Even in Abu Ghraib, in Iraq, where prisoners were sexually humiliated, physically abused, systematically with official sanctions.
The jailer said to the commanding general to keep someone in isolation for more than 30 days. Most of the prisoners in the Tiger Cage were Anthony, most of the 18,000 people in long-term solitary confinement were not initially incarcerated as a result of political activity.
Anthony, we're out of time. Thank you. Thank you for being on.
Well, you can just do this.
Let the magic rise.
This is
secret so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why the story behind the story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
All right, thanks for listening to the Revolutionary Freedom Stocks.com.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Chuck Gregory, the New American Dream Radio Show. And our next guest of the evening is Philip Ferrugio. We're going to add Philip into the show right about now. Philip joins me each week from Port Orange, Florida. Philip is a columnist who has published all over the internet. And we also have
Good evening.
Hello, Philip.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay.
I'm sorry. Anthony, I didn't mean to call you back. I accidentally called both of you, so I'm going to take you back out. Thank you.
Okay, sure enough.
Bye-bye. Let me try this again and get it right. Okay, then.
Okay, this is not Anthony.
Okay, hello, Philip! We got you. We got the right person this time.
All I have to say to you is the following. Okay, here we go. Let's get down to it.
Let's get down to it.
Well, it's futile.
Because we're futile.
As of a year ago, Walmart CEO pay was 1,766 times. That of the average worker worldwide. That's 2.3 million employees. Those workers average $21,952 a year with little or no major benefits. Sometimes none at all. The Nike sneaker company CEO received 370 times the pay of median employees, which is $29,955 a year.
Not even the lowest worker.
Yeah. Those Air Jordan or LeBron sneakers, $150 to $200 a pair, equals 3 to 4 days' pay for the aforementioned U.S. worker.
Now think about that.
In 2017, before the pandemic, S&P 500 CEO pay was 361 times their average worker.
Some of these folks earned in excess Of 6,000 times that of the average worker.
If the economy crashes, those fat cats can live off of their savings and bonuses for years while you start selling apples on street corners.
Fact is, only 3% of our populace, 11.8 million,
are mega millionaire households, which does not take into account the worth of their primary property, a.k.a. residences, which factor into the mega millions in many instances.
Now, on the other end of the scale, by the first quarter of 2019, way before the pandemic hit,
5.2 million properties, a.k.a. residences, had underwater mortgages.
So the pandemic arrived, and Uncle Sam got the mortgage holders
to defer those monthly payments owed under a moratorium of, what, a year?
Do you understand that when this thing finally lifts a bit, the homeowners will be expected to ante up and wipe away that indebted slate?
Okay, how is that going to occur when many working stiffs are nothing more than mere serfs?
That is why I say it's the empire stupid.
American corporate capitalism has always been unfair.
Now, my dad was a longshoreman during the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
When I was a kid and we were living on one paycheck until my mom was forced to get a job to keep us afloat,
I recall the many strikes my dad's International Longshoremen's Association Union was involved in.
The right-wing Congress helped many Democrats.
Does that sound familiar?
Passed the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, which canceled out two FDR New Deal pro-labor acts, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, also known as the Wagner Act, and the Federal Anti-Injunction Act of 1932.
Now here are some of the terrible parts of the Taft-Hartley.
A. It allows the president to appoint a board of inquiry to investigate union disputes when he believes a strike would endanger national health and safety,
and then he can obtain an 80-day injunction to stop the continuation of a strike.
B. He declares all closed shops illegal.
C. It permits union shops only after a majority of the employees vote for them.
D. It forbids jurisdictional strikes and secondary boycotts.
And E. It ends the checkoff system whereby the employer collects the union dues.
So each time his contract expired, my dad went on strike.
The president issued a 80-day cooling-off period.
And that was a great way for the captains of corporate capitalism to put a strain on millions of striking workers now out of work with no pay.
My dad wound up driving a taxi cab or a limo for the interim, earning way less than his normal pay.
We had to cut back on certain costly foods and other expenses like new clothes, going to the movies or bowling with friends, and of course there was no vacation until.
Today we have less than 10%, Chuck, of private sector working stiffs in unions.
10%.
Thanks to the public sector unions, who are also under assault,
with only 39% of their working stiffs belonging,
there may still be a scant glimmer of hope.
If our working stiffs do not finally realize that only strong unions can stand up to the fat empire,
then feudalism will strangle us all.
Forget about the Democrats as our saviors.
Look at what the Democrats just did in the House.
Where they are the majority.
They joined with the other right-wing parties, the far-right Republicans, as I call them,
and voted down a too small amendment to cut military spending by a mere 10%.
Can you imagine that 10%?
And they gave it a hard time.
I had joined with many progressive socialist libertarians a few years ago,
demanding a 25% cut in military spending,
sending the savings back to state, city, and towns where the tax was collected.
So, Chuck, my small city of 60 plus thousand would see a rebate of around 70 plus million dollars a year.
$70 plus million a year
would be rebated back to my city.
Yet most of the serfs who live nearby me just don't get it.
They're too propagandized by the Empire's media spin machine to understand how we are all being played
to our detriment.
So in conclusion, the Great Depression of the 30s, as terrible as it was,
still saw many working stiffs waking up from their slumber.
We had a myriad of newspapers, newsletters, and radio shows trumpeting real progressive ideas and ideals.
Today we have only some websites that speak truth to power, and that is all.
The two-party, one-party current apparatus is owned by the super rich.
Thus, we had a Trump versus Hillary fiasco in 2016,
and now a Trump versus Biden joke as well.
So voting will once again be futile,
except for the fact that Trump is so lethal for us working stiffs that even a Biden presidency, terrible as it may be,
will be welcome for the short term.
Now, if that isn't an indication of the futile feudalism
We are knee deep in. Thank you.
Well, Philip, you know, I'm not willing to work an hour for a pair of shoes. Anyhow.
Three or four days work.
Unbelievable. I mean, that's just disgusting. All right. The other thing that I had out of that, you talked about how the, if the economy crashes, that, the rich folks will be able to live off their savings and all that. Well, Maybe not. Because if the economy really crashes, those savings will be gone too.
Well, it'll take a long time to reach ground zero, like you and I. It'll take us a couple of weeks, maybe.
Do you think that they have their stuff, buried in their mattress? I doubt it. If it's in a bank. If the economy really crashes, banks will be gone. And so all that money that people think they have, it's gone too.
I know what you're saying, but the fact of the matter is that it would be so chaotic to even think about it. It really is scary because it would be so chaotic. For so many people like you and me, who are not rich people, and we're not even wealthy, it'll be so hard for all of us if things get really bad. And it's just, I mean, when I read these figures and you heard them, you must have had some reaction.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, I think that you and I and the others, down at our end of the money system, may actually be better able to handle crashes, pandemics, and other disasters, because we're used to living off of pretty much nothing.
I understand what you're saying, but what I'm suggesting is For instance, I'll give you an example. You and I live in Florida, and when the power goes out here, it's really disastrous. If the power goes out for more than a day or two, you're going to lose everything you have in the refrigerator and freezer. And it's going to be horrible. And the heat, Chuck. I mean, the hot weather we have down here, we don't have air conditioning. If we lose air conditioning like we did during Hurricane Matthew for a week, it was abominable. Well, that can happen if the economy crashes. That's true, but power.
But when I was a kid, we used to visit my grandmother in Ormond Beach every summer. I'd stay there the whole summer, and she didn't have any air conditioning.
All right. Well, I mean,
most people did.
That's good for grandma. I mean, it was, but
I loved it back then. I had no problem. I mean, now I'd probably bake my brains, But we have become spoiled, wanting this air conditioning stuff. Yeah, but let me make a point here.
Okay, so if things crash, and all of a sudden, like you said, a lot of banks go under, how are you going to be able to get food? If you don't have money to buy the food, first of all.
Yeah.
What will happen is people who have the money will be able to get the food.
Maybe.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how it's going to happen, but you're right. I don't know.
Look, here's the point. The point I was making in this piece, which I thought you would elaborate on, was that
we got 11 million
people in our country have mega millionaire households. Where they're earning more than $1 million.
That has nothing to do with the value of their homes.
It's just their income.
Right.
That's 318 million. Don't have that luxury.
Right.
That's the rest of the country.
Exactly.
So if you want to factor out what they call the 1%. If you make $200,000 a year, you're actually considered part of the 1%. If one person earns, they are really part of the 1%. Think about the people that you know all over the place. How many people do I know that are making over $200,000 a year?
Okay, all my doctors, everyone that works for them, everyone that works for them, I'm sure the guy that runs the public store, I would imagine he's probably making maybe $150,000, $180,000, maybe he is.
But all the managers are not making $200,000. That's for sure. So what I'm saying is, how many people do you know that are making over $200,000 a year?
Yeah, right. You're right. The inequality in the distribution of money is horrible. You won't get any argument from me on that. But I don't know. Anyhow, what I found really interesting was your discussion about redistributing all this crazy money that goes to the military and using that to actually help people. I mean, that's a great plan. I don't think we'll ever see it happen because we are so locked into this super rich running everything. We have very little power, but we do have voices. So that's why let me just say this. Let me interject on what you're saying.
Bernie Sanders ran as a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
Democratic socialist, which he's really not. He thinks he is, but he's not. The reason why I'm saying that, any real socialist would not want to see a 10% cut. In the military spending, when everyone knows that about half of our tax money goes through a discretionary spending in other budgets, it's about half. You suggested a 25% cut.
I suggest keeping 25% or less of the of that budget. So 75, 80% cut. That's where I'm at. Yeah, 25% is nowhere near enough. But the point is that Sanders, the Democratic Party, couldn't even agree on a 10% cut. It's not just Republicans, it's all of them.
They're all the hot air.
Yep. I mean, look what...
That's my point.
You know, look what happened the last time we had a governor's race here in Florida. We had a chance for some real change, and we, you know, voted for the status quo.
But the guy running against Sanders was not really behind, super progressive. He was a typical Democrat. He was actually a pretty progressive guy.
But not as progressive as you would want him to be. Yeah. Well, he would certainly
Sanders
isn't a big enough step for me either, but he'd be better than what's going on now.
I understand that. But the point I'm making is that you don't hear anything from the Democrats. talking about universal basic income. I mean, they don't even talk about it. Why aren't they talking about it? Because they don't need it. Well, they're part of a corporate party. We have two corporate parties in this country.
Yep.
One has gone off the radar, off the reservation, so crazy. The Republicans, I call them the Republicans.
Right.
And then you have the other ones who are right wing themselves, and they're the only option that people see. So I'm going to vote for that option this one time. I'm going to do it. But after this is over, I'm never going to support a Democrat again.
Yeah.
Because I hope they win the election, I'll vote for them, but they don't do shit.
I don't see a big change coming from them, and, well, frankly, I don't really see them winning either, but we'll see what happens.
Well, like I tell you, the only reason I'm going to vote for the Democrats is because I am fearful of what this white supremacist, neo-colonial fascist mindset has taken a hold in the United States, which is being really sheltered by the Trump administration.
And it's scary.
It really is scary. These people are crazy. They really are.
We watched a strange movie this morning. Vice. Have you seen it?
No, that's the one about Dick Cheney?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen it yet. How is it?
On the one hand, it seemed like it was, you know, exposing him for the, you know, ambitious and, you know, and ruthless person that he was, and then at the end it was like all lovey-dovey, and then all of a sudden it was over. I'm going, what happened?
I don't know. That's ridiculous.
So kind of a mixed bag.
Lovey-dovey.
Well, basically the, he decided to get out of politics because he decided to support his daughter instead of his career.
Okay, his gay daughter?
Right. I don't know.
So it was kind of hard to swallow.
Suddenly that became the center of the reservation on the right wing, right? Yeah.
His wife.
Yeah.
And I think, so I mean...
Lynn is her name.
Look, Cheney is such a hypocrite. The man supported the Vietnam War when he was of age, and he got all kinds of draft firms.
He didn't have to go. He supported anything that helped him. Yeah, and that part, at least, pretty much came out in the movie, that he was really not about any... And first he was like a disciple of Rumsfeld, and then, you know, it was sort of the role reversal, but I don't know. It was weird. You probably should watch it. We got it from Netflix, you know, as a DVD rental, but I didn't really like it much.
Here's the funny part, Chuck.
Yeah.
Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush Jr.
Yeah.
The others in his administration. What's her name? The woman. Rice.
Condoleezza. Barack Obama.
Those people are war criminals.
I know.
And Donald Trump. Those people are actually war criminals. They have initiated actions.
that internationally are looked upon as being war crimes.
I know, but fortunately for them, we don't recognize the international court, so, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but God does. Yeah, but you know what? God does. And the universe does.
Actually, God has his own court.
I believe in karma.
No, I do.
And I believe that when your soul leaves this plane of existence, it will be held accountable for how it behaved.
Right. Of course, you know, if you...
If you end up coming back as a cockroach,
you know, it's going to be such a short life. You know, does it really matter that much?
Well, if you come back as a cockroach, you have a good chance of getting elected.
Ah, there you go.
Right.
Or a snake.
I mean,
okay, well, you know, all right.
But anyway, all I can suggest to you is that Sleepy Joe Biden, when he smiles, when they do a side smile, he looks like a shark.
Yeah.
He smiles like a crocodile. It doesn't bother me if he falls asleep all the time
because I do that too. So.
Okay. I heard it, but I shouldn't say it's a joke.
Anyway, I guess our time is up, right? Yeah, it is. Hey, this was fun. Yeah, we got to banter a little bit instead of just being too serious. So. All right.
Well, you got to be serious too, and you got to have a good
Well, of course you do, but if you can't laugh... you're really in trouble. Thank you, Philip.
Yeah. All right, you have a good one, Chuck.
You too. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Join the Astrology. Join the Astrology.
and guests on Adventure of Fairfield. It touches Earth Radio 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. And we are very happy to be streaming here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And our next guest of the evening is Larry Pinkney. Larry joins us on the third Thursday of every month from Minneapolis. Larry is an original Black Panther, and we're very fortunate to have him joining us on the New American Dream. So we are calling him up right now in Minneapolis.
Good evening.
Well, hello, Larry. It's Chuck Gregory, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Well, thank you, my brother Chuck Gregory. I hope you are doing well. And the struggle continues. I'm going to be very succinct. I repeat, very succinct. I am quite frankly sick and tired of people attacking our republic.
All right?
We are not perfect. We have never claimed to be perfect.
All right.
But you don't attack senior citizens, burn down their buildings, burn down their residences, loot, etc. Enough is enough, people.
Really, hello.
Somebody tell people in Portland that enough is enough. Somebody tell people throughout this country that enough is enough.
All right? All the rhetoric and all the nonsense and the BS that we get. Enough.
We've had enough.
All right?
This is our republic.
Our grapes might be sour, as the Cuban would say.
But they are our grapes. They're ours. And I believe, frankly, that it is time for people to come to their senses.
They have, I don't know what it is.
Are they crazy? Are they insane? It's like, I find it very strange, for example, that Donald J. Trump received awards. I repeat, awards from the NAACP, from the Rainbow Coalition, etc., before he became president. But suddenly, after he became president, he was a racist. Enough.
This is ridiculous. It's time for us to unify as a nation, to unify as a people.
All right?
So I'm done with that. That's all I have to say. You all can go wherever you want to go. Democrat, Republican, independent, whatever. All I ask is that you be a critical thinker. Thanks. All power to the people.
Well, very good, Larry. You're absolutely right. You know, we have to stop the fighting in general. You know, let alone when it gets so out of hand with this looting and so forth. And critical thinking you mentioned. We have to talk to each other. We have to listen to each other.
Right. You're absolutely right. But see, we don't talk to each other. We don't listen to each other. We get all turned up and quiet up. I don't know what it is. It's insanity to me. It's like, hello, people, wake the freak up. Get a grip on life. You know, we need to listen to each other. We don't have to agree, disagree, or whatever. But listen to each other. And go from there. So anyway, I'm sorry, my brother.
If only it were insanity, maybe we could figure out some way to deal with it. But it seems to be a total lack of respect for each other. A lack of education about each other's views, and not even a willingness to understand that somebody else might actually have a different opinion.
And it might be legitimate.
Exactly.
We don't have to agree with it. I'm the only U.S. citizen and Black Panther Party veteran in history. To have successfully self-authored a case to the United Nations and won. Why did I say that? I said that to make a point. There were all kinds of naysayers around me. How can you expect the UN to pay attention to you? People who are supposed to be my friends and allies, stop it! Wake up! That's all I'm asking people to do. Stop it. Stop going, as H. Brown used to say. Stop going for the ghost. Be real.
Yes. And be honest.
I know it's hard. But we can do that. We must do that. This is our republic. And I'm sick and tired of people attacking our republic. As if we are some kind of Satan. We are not. We have done great things and we have done diabolical things. But we have tried and are still trying to make this nation, this republic, real. And R-E-A-L, capital letters. So, you know, all this nonsense, I'm sick of it, my brother Chuck.
Yeah, I'm sick of it.
So I'm done. I'm sorry. I said I was done before. I'm done now.
Larry, thank you for being here. Thank you for always having a strong opinion and for being willing to share it with us. And willing to listen at the same time.
Thank you, my brother. All power to the people. Let's stay strong. Let's be united and carry on together. Thank you, my brother Chuck. Take care. Love to you, Larry. And to the audience.
All right. Love from me, too. All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, then. Next, we're going to have... a talk that I had earlier with Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. And I'm going to play that right about now.
Hey, Frank.
Hey, Chuck.
How are you?
I'm
outside noise at all, but that's okay.
So,
Frank's interview from a couple of weeks ago on the show that didn't completely happen. But I did speak again with Frank today, and since it's no longer the anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I'm going to go ahead and play my talk with him today, which had some more current events that are happening right out there at the Des Moines Catholic Worker. And here we go.
Restaurant down on the side. Our electrician said, really, after 25 years, I've never seen So much damage done. Without any consequences.
Wow.
So that happened. Why should we think it's a miracle? Lots of volunteers, people are helping, and as far as our justice work, this is the best stuff we do.
Well, what a horror story that was from Frank Cordero at the Des Moines Catholic Worker. But fortunately, nothing major happened. Talk to you on the other side of the station break, folks.
Someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays for Voices on the Wind? With me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under the fire, children at the cans.
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions through the elements and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropism, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
This is disloyal.
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot you back.
No, of course.
That's for me.
Give me liberty! Oh, give me death!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the state criminal power structure that has ruled over our land for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given and we shall not right-winning power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at it, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in the ensuing takedown of a global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening. One with your official break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. We are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And our final guest of this evening is a good one. M.K. Davis, and he told me earlier he's been doing some traveling, and he's going to be telling us about it, so we're going to find out what's going on there. M.K. is our Bigfoot researcher, and he's a very interesting guy, so here we go. As far as I know, he's back in Mississippi now. We will soon see. Should be joining us anytime now.
Hello.
Well, hello, MK.
Hello, MK.
Hey, it's Chuck Gregory, New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, I've been a traveler. I've been out west in the great state of Idaho, and now I'm back in the Midwest in the great state of Indiana. So I've been traveling, I drove all night to get here, and as you might guess, I'm a little bit on the tired side, but not too keen to talk about what I've been doing. And what I've been doing is it's kind of placed up in Jarvis, Nevada, and sort of running out of the woods, you might say. It's called Jarvis Means Monster that lives in the canyon, and it's also been known by another name called Sahabits, which means giant hairy monster, cannibalistic monster. Now, what intrigued me about it was that there's a lake in the Ghost with the Lovelock area about giant hairy cannibalistic monster. And when I went spoke with the Lovelock tribe council about it, they gave me kind of a rundown on what their information was on that. They said that these cannibalistic Harry Johns came down the Humboldt River. The Humboldt River comes out of the mountains, goes down to Winnemucca, Nevada, and cuts across the Lovelock, and then right across from Lovelock Cave, actually. Now, the other end of the Humboldt River goes up to the Jarbidge Wilderness area. And if you follow the river, or trace the river, it goes up to that area where we were in this past week. And that's where they named that area Jarbidge, or Monster that lives in the canyon, Giant Hairy Monster. So you've got two legends of a giant red-haired, cannibalistic giant living on either end of the river. Of a single river. And so, with my Lovelock adventures and excursions, we had found this large handprint inside that cave. And so I became intrigued by the other end of the river. And what was up in that area. So we made an exploration out of that area. Now, what I can determine is that the area where these giant cannibalistic hairy monsters lived was around this particular mountain peak called the Matterhorn. And they call it the Matterhorn because the very top of it has a complete cliff. And it kind of resembles the Matterhorn, the original Matterhorn being in the area. So they call this the Matterhorn. It's roughly about 10,900 feet high. I think it's the 10th tallest mountain in the lower 48 states. So it's really tall. The lay of the land begins to change as you approach the mountain. When you first come up from the Jarbidge, the town of Jarbidge, you're kind of down in a canyon, and up on either side is rock formations and things like that. It sort of looks like the Grand Canyon, in a way. But as you approach the Matterhorn, the land begins to change, and so you have less of that and more spread open, not as steep or tall, in other words, more supportive of living things. The trail that we were on, if you continue to walk it, is an old Indian trail. You will come out into a valley just outside of the mountains there, but you can be at the headwaters of the Humboldt River. So you can imagine that they say that the red giant came down the Humboldt River to the Lovelock. So that would put them in the Jarbidge area. So it begins to make a little more sense to me, just looking at this, this is the area of the lay of the land and things like that, that they would be their home range is probably within that metaphor. And that when they come out of there, for whatever reason they came out at that time, and then the terror was the Pisces, they came down the river to do it. So, we were able to go back in there and some of that area, but like some of the other things, time did not allow a complete thorough investigation, so it wants a return trip, and some of the oldest petroglyphs in the entire United States. We're in that area. They're roughly about 10,500 years old. So what are we looking at there? Are we looking at all kinds of theories about it? I don't know if they came out of those home ranges up there due to some kind of a celebration thing, whether they just didn't even run out of it, but they have war with the tribes, the Lovell Paiute tribes, and some other tribes as well, and Sarah Wanamaka. the daughter of the chief, one of them, she stated in her book that she had a dress that was passed down to her, that part of the dress had the red hair sewn into it from those red-haired giants. So, you know, this is not... This is not something that's pie in the sky. I don't believe it. I think that it's rooted in the truth, and that on either end of the Humboldt River, you were subject to seeing, or you had a high likelihood that you would encounter one of these particular types. And so the whole region reeks of it. My good friend Don Monroe, back 40 plus years ago, photographed a giant skull in the basement of the Humboldt Museum there in Winnemucca. And this skull had overcrowded teeth, and the top row of teeth had erupted in front of them, and they ended up with double rows in the top. But the bottom, even though it did not have double rows, it's still overcrowded. It had denture problems. And it also had a rocker jaw that seemed to indicate that its heritage might have been from the Pacific. So, you know, the Polynesian. Are the only people that had a jaw that was turned up. In the front, and that would rock rather than lay flush. So this appeared to be that type of a jaw, and it was a giant individual. It had one of those things all over the bone. So it kind of is what it is. Some people feel as could be anything from an epilogue to just a cannibal, you know, that warrants further investigation, and I feel pretty sure that at some point in time, if nothing's in the way, I may back up there and spend a few days in the Matterhorn Mountain, and maybe even walk to Indian Trail out to the end and try to access the Humboldt and come down the Humboldt myself.
Great adventures, MK. I'll tell you, that high country sounds just amazing. So where did you say you are right now?
I'm in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Oh, okay. That's very cool. Do you drive all these places? Do you have some kind of a special vehicle, or you're just driving in your car, or what?
Ford F-150 with a full drive and double low. Double gears. In other words, it would just crawl very slowly. We forded streams with it and all kinds of stuff. You know, we got back in there, and once we got back in there, we were able to access that trail. What they are, I don't know, we've got to get close and go look.
Yeah. If they'll let you.
if they'll let you get away.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly, right.
Somebody's got to let you come in, but
you can never leave. It's like the Hotel California.
The hotel garbage. You may check it out.
Yeah.
well, that was my adventure for a little time. I've got some of my journals and pictures.
It sounds like a great adventure. I need a road trip soon. I don't know. I haven't been on a road trip for years.
Well, I'm not the greatest outdoorsman in the world, but I was able to pull it off. And I feel very certain that you could pull it off.
Well, what I'm saying is you don't have to run to the medicine to go back in there. Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm sure I could.
You can walk that trail, you know.
I would, man. I know I would. Yeah, I'm pretty healthy, and yeah. It's getting there. I have a problem with.
Well, it's a long way, but as far as knowing exactly where to go, the Forest Service put boulders over that trail to block vehicles.
Yeah, they denied access to the vehicles.
So they cut out a lot of traffic that used to come in there, the horse trains, and just walk at the horses, and it's just a person doing it.
Well, it really does sound fascinating. MK, thank you for being with me on this third Thursday every month, and thanks for this amazing story tonight.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to be posting some photos along the way. Why don't you remind the listeners
where they can find the photos and videos?
Well, if you want to be my friend on Facebook, you tell me, hey Davis, and you send me sitting in your chair reading a book. So that's several MKs, but that's me. And also, there's a lot of public stuff there, so you can still click on it anyway. And then I'm going to put some on my blog as well, the davisreport.wordpress.com. So be looking for some stuff there regarding the same trip. And I think that ultimately it's going to lead somewhere when it comes to giants. And maybe perhaps it's enough material there to lead me to believe that it's more than just somebody's supposition, it's rooted in facts.
Well, all right. I hope you get to find something. And
yes, sir.
In the meantime, have a nice visit in Indy, and a safe trip. And I look forward to visiting with you again next month.
All right, thank you.
Hey, that sounds good. All right. I'm up for it.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again, MK. All right. And listeners, thank you. Thank you for being here for the new American Dream Radio Show right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It is a listener-supported network, and they do a lot of great work, and they keep two streams of radio going pretty much 24/7. So, you know, check in, listen to them, and head over to freedomslips.com and get, find that donation button, subscribe, and all that stuff. I thank all of you for being here. I am Chuck Gregory. This is the new American Dream Radio Show, signing off for the evening.